Hey you, thanks for tuning into the Waiting List podcast. I'm Long Long.
I'm Daniel.
And I'm Jacqueline, and we are three watch friends with a healthy obsession for watches.
So sit back and relax with us while we chat with collectors, industry giants, and share some good vibes. During my career as a podcaster, we have had tremendous support from the watch community. I think especially in the early stages, it was because of you guys sharing the podcast by word of mouth that it grew to a point where we thought this is actually worth continuing. I actually think not too long ago, we had been downloaded 200,000 times. Is that right, Long?
Yeah.
Right.
211,600.
Well, I guess we have modestly built a following, and occasionally in Hong Kong, I get the odd fanboy who waxes lyrical about the podcast. Each time, I'm quite taken back as I really never know how to respond. And I think one of the things is that for the person listening, like, they've listened to us like a lot, but I've never ever engaged with that person. I have to be honest, sometimes I do wish it was a fangirl instead, but hey, you can't have it all. Our latest guest was exactly like that, who came up to me after being introduced by my mutual friend and colleague, Gertrude, saying, "I'm addicted to your podcast. It's like crack cocaine." I just want to say flattery does work, and we now have him on as a guest. It's Gaurav Rekhi, aka High End Time on Instagram. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks very much. Thanks very much for having me. It's very kind. I didn't know you'd remember that, actually. But wait, so you're featuring me three episodes after Goldberger, Gertrude, and Mike Nouveau. Are you guys feeling okay, both of you? I mean, this is definitely a new high for your podcast. It's a real milestone. You know, I mean, Goldberger's butter knife has more followers than I do, but that's a different story. Thank you very much.
We never said that we're going to release you in that order, right?
All right.
Yeah. All right. Before we delve into your collection and your taste, I was trying to get to know the person first. So tell us in the audience a little bit about yourself, your background and stuff.
Yeah. So look, in many ways, I'm like the three of you. I have the three of you in me, the way I look at it. So for example, Jack, and I know she isn't here. I share her taste in, you know, vintage Patek, Breguet. She needs to actually find me one similar to what she found for Seb, you know, the beautiful tuxedo Breguet that she found for him. Seb's a friend as well, by the way.
I can tell you that there's one in the Geneva.
One coming up. And I know, I was discussing with Gertrude last night. She wants me to come live with her, but I'm never going to do that because it's just daunting, absolutely, having Gertrude on the other side, you know, and bidding for that watch. Anyway, so I share Lung Lung's passion as well, mostly for modern and neo AP. Including the double balance, but let's talk about that later as well, Dan, because I know you like the double balance. And I also share your taste, you know, for some of the sort of unforgotten icons like Movado, you know, vintage watches with clean dials that go well with suits, etc. And like you, I also don't get Grand Seiko. So let me just put that out right up front. And
what
again,
do you mean? I'm a huge fan of Grand Seiko.
Really? Since when? So yeah, so look, what am I? I'm Gaurav. I'm actually a watch collector from a very, very long time ago. I was telling Dan the other day, I've got socks that are older than him. I might be wearing them actually. You know, I'm also called High End Time. Mm-hmm. And for some of those that know me, they also call me the Roth Father. And that's because of my fascination for everything Daniel Roth. I come from a very prominent business family in India. Mm-hmm. I've lived and worked across the UK, the US, and now in Asia. I'm a banker by profession, mm-hmm. but I'm also a collector. And actually, I'm also a watch dealer, or I was for a bit. So my mm-hmm. journey was quite interesting. I was a collector, then became a dealer, then went back to being a collector. And I have a day job, but it's a fully declared outside mm-hmm. activity or a hobby in this case. Mm-hmm. And even if you look at IG, 75% of what I have, it says private collection, not for sale. So I'm one of those guys that I like to curate, you know, content. I like to curate watches, but I buy far more than I sell. I mean, I have over 150 pieces. It's very much a labor of love for me and a passion, long-standing passion, actually.
Mm. All right. We don't usually get like collectors coming from India. Well, they're few and far between on this podcast. But so I always like to take the opportunity to explore like how is India's like watch collecting culture? And this, yeah, what is it like?
Yeah, so look, I mean, I can talk a lot about this. I spent most of my life outside India. I was born in India, but I went to college in the US. I was educated in Carnegie Mellon. I spent a lot of time with a company called Goldman Sachs in New York and London, and spent a long time living in London. So I actually haven't been back to India in many, many, many years. So I mean, I took a short stint, 2 or 3 years. Didn't like the experience much. Loved being home, but that's the only thing I liked about it, you know. But how's the watch culture? I mean, you can actually, first of all, there's a genuine love for watches in India. And you can kind of see that in some of the recent individuals from that country who are in the watch hobby. So, you know, there's a lady that writes for Wrist Check. I can't remember her name,
Name
Neha,
her,
I think.
yeah.
Yeah, that's her name. And then you had Amrita here actually on your
Yeah,
podcast. She's
yeah,
with Tatler GMT.
yeah.
So you know, there's quite a few. I mean, I think there's a growing appreciation for watches, but like China, you've got to understand, India has a lot of new wealth, so the taste hasn't really had a time to develop as yet. So you know, unfortunately, what I find is it's largely a show-off culture. The collectors there, or at least the ones that I know of, are largely hype-driven. You know, it's a bit of a flex culture. Rolex, modern Rolex, as you'd expect, is absolutely king, you know. And how much a watch costs, which actor or actress is wearing what car you're driving, etc., defines taste. So it's a little bit of a pseudo cult culture. You know, we talk about quality of watches, we talk about anglage. I mean, a lot of collectors there that I know, good friends. I don't know if they'll be friends after this podcast, but so far they are. They wouldn't know anglage if it hit them in the face, right? So you know, I remember conversations with my father-in-law kind of talking or bragging about his modern Rolex and me sitting down pretending to be interested, but secretly I'm almost sort of yawning, you know, and thinking, yeah, okay, they're popular, but they're cheap. I mean, you know, you have Hulk, Batman, Pepsi, Big Mac, Little Mac, I don't know, Whopper. Well, I have nothing against modern Rolex. I mean, they're a good watch, but I would hardly call them luxury, right? So it's, you know, so that's what India is about. It's a lot of new money, which is being spent on luxury. Now, there is old wealth, but that's totally different, right? So, I mean, I give you an example of my dad. My dad is a very wealthy gentleman. We have substantial assets back home. And I remember when I bought him a watch about 15, 20 years ago, it was a Cartier, right? He wanted just something small. And that by that time, no one bought Cartier, to be honest. It's not like today, right? And I remember giving it to him on his birthday, and he was like, it was a 36 millimeter Cartier Ronde. And he was like, this is a beautiful watch. And I was like, you know, he said, how much did it cost? And I kind of told him what I'd paid for it. And I still remember his answer. He's like, oh my God, for that price, I can have five people walking around telling me the time anytime I want it. This is the difference, right? Between old wealth and new wealth, you know, from an India standpoint. So I think the metamorphosis is yet to happen in India. I mean, it's still a caterpillar, not really a butterfly. But that being said, there's a lot of, you know, things are looking up. And by the way, India has watchmaking heritage, right? I mean, if you look at Boucheron, which is what I also collect. So I'm trying to go from the Rothfather, which sounds too old, to the Boucheron boy, which is a bit younger and more modern, right? You look at the Maharaja of Patiala, who was one of the customers of Boucheron. And I've got a couple of watches from sort of that period in my collection as well. You look at people like Ronnie. You know, Ronnie's, I don't know if you've had Ronnie. I think you might have had him on the podcast. I mean, he's Indian descent. And that's the sort of family I come from as well. So I totally get his taste because my taste is very similar. Gilbert, Albert, you know, pieces like that. But, you know, it's sad. A lot of the regular collectors are chasing hype. But at the same time, I think the taste is evolving.
Right, go for it, Long.
So that's like a very good description of like India. And then now you're living in Hong Kong. So how would you describe Hong Kong's watch culture?
Oh, totally chalk from cheese. I mean, I would say Hong Kong is many, many years I mean, first of all, there's a lot of old wealth in Hong Kong, you know, and I absolutely love this city. And I think there are three, they say there are three temples of watches in the world. One of them is Hong Kong. The other is Dubai, so I hear. And then one is where you're from, Lung Lung, Singapore. You know, to some extent, I mean, I'm not very familiar with Singaporean culture, but I believe that's another temple. So for me, being into watches, you know, ever since Dan was running around half naked in boxers, you know, I think I have to live in one of these three centers. So how does Hong Kong compare? I remember you had a Revolution podcast where they asked Dan the same question, and I think his answer was quite good. It's much more deep, but it's narrow. So everyone knows everyone else. You know, for example, you have my good friends from the THC, from the Horology Club, who I know featured, you know, Jonathan, Helbert, et cetera, featured on your podcast. You know, they have eclectic tastes. You know, so you find a lot of old Rolex. You find a lot of independence. You find, like I like, a lot of new vintage and vintage independence, some of the older things. So I think, but it's also Rolex culture. So I think Hong Kong has always had it's a bit of a passion here, actually. It's a bit of a culture, religion here, watches. And it's one of the things I absolutely love about Hong Kong. You know, I couldn't be doing this anywhere else in the world. And, you know, and that's why I'm here. So, yeah, I think it's far more evolved than India. And actually, you can look at Macau and Hong Kong and look at the differences in the culture. And that's also stark. Right? Macau is a lot still old Rolex. So it's about 10, 15 years behind Hong Kong, whereas Hong Kong, I think, is really fast moving and evolving when it comes to watches.
Yeah. So basically, I just want to say, like, I didn't really spend many years running around in boxes. I think it was like just about maybe 2 years in my insecure, like teenage years, maybe Bart Simpson, but it didn't like, you know.
I mean, 3 years ago.
No, it wasn't 2 years ago. Yeah. I wish. Yeah. But I wanted to go back. You love Hong Kong.
Yeah, absolutely love it.
That you weren't that fond of India. Like, can you tell me why?
Look, so, I mean, I love India. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I absolutely love India. There's a lot of, I spent a few years there working. Let's get to the butt. Get to the butt. I mean, other than, so, obviously, I had a family business. You know, my grandfather started India's first hotel, and we great grandfather, and we still own it. It's actually this massive property right in the center of Delhi. We call it it's called Connaught Circus. It's the same Connaught, by the way, Lord Connaught, as I think Connaught Road here in Hong Kong, and it's kind of like owning a piece of landmark. Let's just put it that way. So, I mean, shameless plug. Like when I visit Mark Cho. Armory, you know, the Peta building, it reminds me of home. Actually, it looks a lot like what my property used to be. So those who haven't been, you know, to your listeners must go to check out Mark and Peta. I think he's done a fantastic job. So look, back then I felt like a little bit of a black sheep for not coming back to India, being outside, following my own path because of the heritage, because of the assets back home, etc. But today, if I look back, a lot of the ones that actually stayed back and joined their family businesses are the black sheep. You know, and other than a few really big industrialists who I went to college with, who were pretty big enough to begin with, I don't know of a single one of my peers and colleagues who had sort of went back home or stayed back, who I could call a huge success. You know, this is including cousins, friends, in-laws. And secretly, a lot of them actually wish they had followed my path, right? So while there's so many positives to India, culture, history, heritage, it's a land of ironies. You know, there's infrastructure issues, there's massive traffic problems, there's pollution. I think I heard last week or 2 weeks ago, Delhi is one of the most polluted cities in the world. There's a lot of politics, right? Massive amount of politics, corruption. I mean, I think, you know, we've all seen China change and India's undergoing a similar transformation. And there's a lot of beauty to being in India. It's a beautiful country. And I don't want to make this like all negative, but there's a lot of friction. A lot of friction in day-to-day life. And there's almost this sense of frustration as an undercurrent. Now, living in your parents' house with your parents is considered safe, right? It's a safe thing. But in an interesting irony, living with them in the safety of the home makes you too safe, I feel. So it reduces your ability to take risk. You know, and I see that in a lot of my sort of friends, family back home. And you can see this, right? The really successful businesses in the last 5-6 years in India are all upstarts. They have no family backing. They're all digital businesses. Our population is a massive differentiator. You know, we love to have babies in India, mm-hmm. as many as possible. And therefore, mm-hmm. we need scale. And I think digital has scale. So that's mm-hmm. sort of new businesses. So, you know, it's not like I don't like India, but like my mother said it best, right? She said, you know, we've given you roots, but we've also given you wings. So in a way, we have the best of both worlds. We can always go back. The others who may have joined their family businesses or went back, they have no wings. You know, they're imprisoned in their own, in their parents' houses, imprisoned in their parents' personalities. And I like being my own man. And, you know, I've always got sort of been my own man. So that's the other reason.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, that was a very good answer. It was actually the answer to my next question, which was like, because you did mention the black sheep thing in our pre-call. And I just thought, wow, there's probably a story there because, you know, pretty much all Chinese families have their own version of a successful TVB series. And I thought, you know, you could have your own Indian TVB series. Like, you know what I mean, Long Thing?
So you wanted to monetize the podcast. Here's an idea right here, right? I mean, go TVB next.
Right. We're going to go on to the watches now. You are known as the Rothfather, right? I'm just going to, it's pretty obvious why, right? But how did you become the Rothfather? Like, who did you have to kill?
I had to make a lot of offers to people that they can't refuse. A lot of them sleep with the fishes looking for the movie.
And you have
no idea what we're talking about, right? She's sort of looking at some.
Yeah, have you seen The Godfather long?
No, snippets of it.
Oh, okay. Right.
Wait, tell me.
No, just my, like, you know, there's people screaming right now. They just say, no way.
I know, but I only watched Top Gun recently, right? So
okay. It's a movie made from a time where they don't make movies like that anymore, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the finest movies I've ever seen. And my dad loves it as well, actually. He says there's a lot of life, business, wisdom, all the Godfather. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there is, yeah.
Okay, like I will watch it in April.
Make it a podcast on its own, like long, mm-hmm. catching up on like 80s
as
movies.
All the movies that.
What did you think of this? Yeah.
Lung has to also show up to one of the events. She's been promising this.
Okay, by the way.
After the events, she'll be watching the Godfather.
Okay, I don't think Jonathan will listen to this or Halbert or Carlos, but I'm not lying about this. I was skeptical about even connecting with them for as long as they have been around, like since they started THC. And they finally agreed. And Dan, this is the time you went. Like I said, can we just meet at Shake Shack? So I met all three of them. Yeah. And after that, I was like, I want to go. But I told them I want to go to the ones that I want to go to. So like Space One, I wasn't in Hong Kong, but I actually really wanted to go. But they know, like, I'm weird, but I want to go now. You know, I really love them.
Takes one to know one, Lung. I look forward to seeing you one of them, actually. We can talk about our AP stories. We can tell you a whole lot more that I haven't said yet.
Okay, cool. Let's do it.
Awesome. So the question was, why Roth, right? Or how did you become the Rothfather? So, you know, if I were to ask you to name 3 to 5 of the greatest horological figures of all time, what would they be? Who would you name?
Probably someone from Paddock, like Hans Wildorf. Don't know.
George Daniels.
Gentler.
Yeah, I was thinking George Daniels and Philip Dufour.
Perfect. So look, George Daniels, Abraham Louis Breguet, Genta, Philip Dufour, right? We'd say these are. Now, Daniel Roth is associated with all of them. Right, he took over AP, right? So he was essentially the head watchmaker at AP. He resurrected Breguet with Genta, by the way. Mm-hmm. You know, taking on from the greatest horological, from my perspective, individual ever, which is Abraham Louis Breguet. He was inspired by George Daniels. You know, look at the Hornby pocket watch, and then look at any of Daniel Roth's retrogrades. It's exact same design. So this is why I got into Roth. You know, it was actually the, you know, I was, my collection sort of even 4 years ago was sort of 20 Nautilus, 35 AP, you know, every modern Rolex you can think of. Well, I still have a lot of them, but actually if you look at it today, it's almost exactly the opposite. Huge amounts of Roth, huge amounts of Dubuis, right? Breguet, vintage Breguet, except for the tuxedo that Jack has to find me with Sebastian, except for that one and the other one at auction. You know, so this is why, I mean, honestly, Roth is heritage, massive amounts of heritage. It's fantastic quality, best of the best in all cases. Frederick Piguet movements, Lemania, you know, all the Anglage, Perlage, and the Larges you can think of, all executed manually, you know, without any computer operated machines, without any CNC. Literally used to sit down with a Burin, which is a, you know, a tool, and he used to hand carve. I mean, I've got a couple of skeletons, and you can look at them for hours. I mean, I'm totally geeking out right over this Campari, but you can literally sit down with a lens and you can look at these things for hours. They're that beautiful. It's literally art on your wrist. So heritage, quality, and then rarity. You know, absolute rarity. Production numbers were extremely limited. I just picked up two of the rarest perpetual calendars Daniel Roth had ever made. One of them was last week. One of them was sort of a month and a half back. I mean, the one I picked up last week, I think there's one of three. And the one, I mean, that's literally what we're talking about. And, you know, he was underappreciated. So that's how I got into Roth. To me, it completely epitomizes the highest quality of watchmaking. And how did I become the Roth father? In a very, very short time, literally 1.5 to 2 years, I've bought every single one, except for the Tourbillon. I have pretty much all the models. First series, second series, a few second series, a few third series. I mean, I'm not like sort of one of those has to be the first, but the first series is the highest quality. So that's what I specialize in.
I have a random question from how you described your collection. So you said you were one of those people, Nautilus, AP, so on, so on. What was the reason so when did you shift into this? And then what was the reason you went, okay, enough of this, let's go into this now?
So my journey was collector to dealer back to collector.
Okay.
Dealer period in the middle, which was a short period. I'm still a dealer, right? But I'm a different type of dealer. I'm more of a collector than a dealer. But that dealer period in the middle was when I was actually buying and selling a lot of modern pieces. And even though I started out with a whole bunch of modern pieces, I think that's what killed it for me. Because once you become transactional about it, you start looking at it at what it really is, which is a commodity.
Yeah.
Nothing more than a commodity. And like everything, you know, refinement, right? You start with, you know, those, I mean, even if for example, I hate to use the analogy of a drink, but you start with those cheap sodas you get, like, you know, the cheap drinks that you get in shot glasses in 7-Eleven. And then eventually you start appreciating fine wine. I know you're laughing. And, you know, think like there are much deeper. So similar, like you started with this, I don't think Patek is a cheap shot. There goes my, I'll never get another Patek as long as I live. But you know, you start kind of moving into this more refinement. You go deeper into the rabbit hole. And then you discover new rabbit holes. So how did that change? I think the dealer bit killed it for me. Then I discovered true quality. And then I started seeing that these things are actually ubiquitous. You know, if I have a 5711, there's a lot of 5711s. I have a 5711, 5712, 5726, but there's too many of them anyway. So does everyone else, right? Mm. But then when you look at a Roth, how many exist? I mean, I've got a skeleton. He made three. I have an old bicompact. He only made three.
So why didn't you look at independence?
Good question. And I'm still looking at independence. To be honest, it's not like I didn't look at independence. I own some Andersons. Right. I mean, I met Max Bousset a couple of times when he was here. I love MBF. I love De Bethune. But again, they're a bit too big. You know, I've got pencil wrists. I think my wrists are smaller than yours, actually. Long. Not that it means anything.
Compare one day.
We will soon at the next THC event. But yeah, I think, you know, pieces are big. So they're not tasteful. Right. Okay. And then the other thing is, I went independent. Roth is an independent.
Yeah.
Right. I went neo vintage independence because I felt those were rarer and they had horological muscle to them as well. You know, I can talk volumes about a retrograde and the Edward Hornby, you know, which is made by George Daniels, and why Abraham Louis Breguet influenced him, and what was difference about some of his, you know, bicompax chronos, etc. But I can't talk about the design language of de Bethune with that lens. I can maybe a little bit, but not. I can talk about Chaumé and how Chaumé led to some of the, you know, but I can't talk with the same. It doesn't have the same history as that. So it's more personal taste, really. I get independence totally, but you must note these brands I'm talking about, Breguet, Roth, they've actually seen many hype cycles, many falls, many crashes. These modern independents really haven't seen too many. They're still a new phenomenon, right? Yeah. And I think we heard about it, what a month back or 2 or 3 weeks back, Christopher Claret, or one of the brands, went bankrupt. So we don't know whether they're really poised to last that long, you know, especially through recessions. But yeah, I can understand the quality, and I can understand, you know, they're very similar to what the kind of aesthetic that I like, yes.
Okay.
You know, you see Daniel Roth so highly, but why do you think the market doesn't? Because the prices of Daniel Roth do not reach the prices of Dufour or George Daniels.
So, very good question. And actually, two of the watches I just bought last week were made by Philippe Dufour. It was Philippe Dufour working with Daniel Roth to make first the Perpetual that didn't cut over instantaneously in 1993. And then they followed it up with a second one, which they again made together, which was the first world's first instantaneous Perpetual calendar. I found them both in rose gold, salmon dials, full set. You'll see them come up on my IG very soon, actually. So why was Roth underappreciated? Again, couple of reasons. First of all, you're talking about an artist running a business. If you look at the catalogs from that period, you know, we're talking late 80s, early 90s, here are some of the prices. 50,000 Swiss francs, 75,000 Swiss francs. What can 75,000 Swiss francs buy in 1988? I mean, a 1 year's salary was $32,000. A house was worth $112,000. So imagine he's selling a watch for the price of a house. You know, a good apartment in Hong Kong, a very good apartment in Hong Kong, like the one I'm living in here, is about 20 million Hong Kong. Imagine paying that for a watch. Imagine paying 10 million for a watch. So I think this is one of the reasons he was a commercial failure, because his quality was just so high and he priced his watches so high that there was no takers. People didn't understand them. So they largely sold dealer to dealer. Provenance was often destroyed and scrapped. It's why so many papers were missing, you know, in Daniel Roth. And a lot of them are even unstamped, actually. But then it was the artist running a business, and the fact that he lost money on almost every single piece. Then his you know, bad luck, right? His financer pulled out, so then he sold it to the Hourglass Company, and then so on and so on. Then Breguet bought them, Bulgari bought them up, and that was the end of Daniel Roth. So that explains why they didn't do well commercially. But I think there's also a very little known fact, little known story that most people haven't heard of. The Sterns wanted to buy Patek. So people in the grapevine, you might have heard of it, Dan, because you're well connected, but they wanted to buy Patek. And the Sterns said numerous times to the Arnolds, the LVMH group, that honestly, Patek is not for sale, right? And this, I hear, this is Arnold's way of getting back at that. So he's basically creating Daniel Roth, which they've resurrected, to take on Patek Philippe. That is their highest end brand in their stable at the moment, or they're positioning it. And I know they haven't released much except for one tourbillon in the last 2 years, but that's the theory, that they want to eventually launch this subscription model, very limited quantity. But to your question, it hasn't reached the price of Dufour yet, agreed. But Dufour itself was involved in some of the movements. So it's only a matter of time, I feel, before it actually hits there or it reaches that level.
But I don't know, man, because I think the information on Roth is all out there. You know, is it the fact, because Daniel Roth uses a very particular case shape, right?
I think it's that also.
It isn't universally accepted, I think the most PC way is saying, right?
No, sure. I mean, it's an acquired taste. Right. But so are a lot of other things. Now, if you look at the new Daniel Roths, which he's making under his own name now, Jean Dalian, Daniel Nicolas, a lot of them, well, he's got a unique case shape, but he's also got a round model. So maybe that's his finally, you know, him appreciating that the shape is not for everyone. But then, to be honest, you look at the stuff coming out of Urwerk, some of which is absolutely incredible. So, I mean, I think the fact that he's actually changed the design language is something that you know, it's about rarity eventually, right? That it has its following, it has its people.
That's what I was going to ask you, because like George Daniels are rare. Dufours are relatively rare. How rare are Daniel Roths in comparison?
So the one problem is there's not, the production numbers aren't really known. There's not much information on production. This was an artist making them himself, you know, steeped over his desk with his burin, cutting the filaments, etc. So, but the first generation Roths are phenomenally rare, right? So the skeleton, I know someone who has lunch with him. He's actually a very good friend of mine. He's the CEO and the owner of Anderson Geneve, Alex, who you might know him as well. He has lunch with Roth, you know, a week, every second week or so, just from a family perspective. And I do know that they were very, very limited. So, I mean, like, if you look at the Bicompact Skeleton first series, the one that I think you sold at Philips as well, you know, late last year. I mean, there were three or four made. You know, if you look at some of these Salmon Dial perpetuals, which Dufour had a role to play in, you're talking about less than five. So again, it's rarity, right? I buy rarity, quality and rarity and heritage. All three of them exist in Roth. I think it's only a matter of time, maybe 5 years from now, 3 years from now, when LVMH finally gets its hand, you know, its act together, and we have a lot more pieces coming out, you'll see, you know, the market picking up again.
The new releases by Roth, are they actually designed by him, or are they just putting a name on it?
So,
because I've heard a lot of stories, it's not, it's just putting a name.
So his, so they've got these two individuals who work for the Fabrique du Temps in LVMH, that are actually, you know, designing the movements, etc. He is involved, but not directly so. But I heard that his son is actually part of the team. So his son is participating in some of those designs. I think he's more of a dignitary, right, in this equation. He doesn't have any control over, you know, what they're producing, but they are sticking very, very true to his models. So they plan to relaunch every single one in the same order as the original first series, right? He's 88 or 89 years old, right? So I don't expect him to sort of visit the factory floor every day, but he is somewhat aware. Yeah.
And do you think he's getting paid, or like, does he, I mean, he's obviously not getting a cut. So I'm just wondering, did he get paid to use his name?
I have no idea. It's one to ask Kevin O'Dell or one of your other, I know they were sort of, they're into Roth as well to some extent. I don't know if he's getting paid, but I think, you know, when your son is already part of this brand, and working there, I think in some way, and they are resurrecting his name. So I think that is payment enough, you know. Imagine if you're sitting there at 88 and your entire life's work is finally being noticed. And it's being paid, that to me is payment enough. I think at that age, money doesn't mean as much. These things matter a whole lot more.
If that kind of setup exists, right, where he's not fully ingrained in the business and the brand is named after him, plus it's owned by LVMH, which is a conglomerate, do you think that it has any chance of being a Patek contender? You know, I mean,
So here's what, you know, I'm very well connected in the Roth community, as you know, right? All the Roths, all the big Roths, eventually they come to me. It's not even I look for them. It's that like the ruby, what you seek is seeking you. So do I think there's any, chance of being a Patek contender? I think let me answer the question slightly differently. Either way, it bodes well for old Roth. So let's say they launch and it's a phenomenal success. Fantastic. Now we have the old Roths that are truly the first he made, hand-built, very rare, immense heritage, immense quality. They will go up. Let's say they launch and it's a complete failure, abysmal, right? Again, you've got the old Roths, which are very limited, and they stand to benefit. So I think either way, it's great for old Roth, because there are not many out there. And at the end of the day, just like independence and Lung Lung's earlier question, you know, this is about rarity, quality, provenance, and heritage. there's not that there literally is not many pieces out there. He hand built every single one in the first.
You really are a Roth fanboy, but that doesn't actually answer my question. You know, like, do you think that it has the ability to be a Patek contender? Not on the watch. You do. All right. Okay.
Yes, totally. Right. I own vintage Patek, right? So I own I know you love some of the vintage Calatravas. I own a 130, very similar to the one you've got listed coming up for auction as well. I can tell you the quality is very, very similar. They're using similar calibers, similar, you know, okay, yes, the case shape is not round. It's double ellipse. But other than that, the quality is there.
Do you think those kind of prices for Patek are because of the quality?
Patek is always Patek, right? So undeniable.
Exactly. That's my point, right?
Patek, and you know, I've got Frank Muller, vintage Frank Muller, that has a very, very strong Patek vibe, double faced, etc. But we're digressing. I mean, I think will it be a Patek contender? I think it has the best chance out of any of the brands I've seen from a neo vintage perspective of being that Patek contender, right? Will it be at that exact same level? No, I mean, I think Patek is Patek. We all know that to some level.
Mm. Yeah, just wondering because, you know, a lot of the, one would argue the more quote-unquote successful brands are independent. And being, you know, how much autonomy will the Daniel Roth brand have still being in the conglomerate? You know, I do somewhat think the fact that Lange is like in the conglomerate does like affect them, you know?
Yeah, and I think Vacheron, you could say the same for Vacheron. I think that is the one anchor behind Roth, I also feel. But you know what, I actually honestly, I know about, let's not go down an AP rabbit hole, but I know as well, if, you know, Roth is actually classic AP in a way, because he was affiliated with AP for so many years. If they had bought it over and released it, as opposed to this code 360, what do they call it? 911, 360, whatever they're calling it nowadays, whatever number it is. As opposed to this, I think they would have had a whole different ballgame. I mean, that, my personal view is AP should have resurrected Roth and launched that as an answer to Patek. So they have the modern Royal Oak and all the, you know, Spider-Man, Superman, Batman, whatever else they want to make. And then they have this gorgeous vintage sort of piece with true heritage coming out to compete with Patek. That's what I would have.
Did basically. You just demolish the code 1159?
I think so.
Yeah, I think you just
It's okay. I've got 25 Nautilus, but I've also got 35 APs. So I don't think even if they don't give me any more, I'm fine with that. I've got every single AP I want. So
like at 35 AP, right?
Yeah.
Like how many Royal Oaks do you need? Do you need 35?
So look, I love the offshore, first of all, which is surprising, right? I love the offshore. And I have some interesting stories about how I got my first AP and how I got into AP in the first place. But I also love Royal Oaks. I love Double Balance. But to answer your question, right? And we've come full circle. I was telling Lung Lung when we started, and when I exchanged notes with her on IG, you know, after her video, I went, my grail was the Double Balance. I finally got called for it last October. It was so profound to someone who's been into watches for so long that I had to celebrate. I found a vintage Oval, you know, rose gold,
mm-hmm.
one of three pieces made, skeleton,
mm-hmm.
just to celebrate the Double Balance. And then I go pick it up with the Oval on my wrist. And obviously everyone at AP House is ooing and awing over this beautiful Oval. And it meant nothing. I mean, I put on the Double Balance next to the Oval. And it didn't resonate at all. It was just cold, stark. And that beautiful Oval, maybe it's age catching up, but that beautiful Oval, full of heritage, full of history. So I'm not saying I don't like the Double Balance, but it was underwhelming, to be honest, compared to some of the vintage.
But do you think it's also because you waited so long? Because I've had
long at all.
For this Double Balance.
Two years.
It's such a joke that you have had every single piece, but you just cannot have this fucking piece for some reason, right?
Agreed.
And this is how I feel with, I think I've now already said it, the Lange, Lange 1 Aventurine dial, that by the time they said, hey, it's here, I was really just like, fuck you, no. Even though I have never said this to their face, but that was what I was thinking.
See, I totally get that. But for me, it wasn't that because I didn't wait that long. I waited 2 months for the Blue Royal Oak, right?
Okay.
I waited probably 2.5, 3 months for Jumbo.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There's a reason why I didn't have to wait, which is a separate story. Yeah. Actually, yeah. I didn't wait much at all. I got the double balance. Okay. I got the green chrono, and then I got the double balance, all within the same year. But I think it was more about, it just felt light. Okay. You know, the edges were too sharp. It was a bit too big.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I paid almost 700,000 Hong Kong dollars.
Yeah.
And it just felt a little bit like light and flimsy, right? I hate
it. I know. I totally know what you're saying, because I feel bad every time I bitch about AP because they've been so nice, right? But
yeah,
I just went to Phillips recently and my friend is dying to get a Royal Oak. And I keep saying, please don't. Like, please reconsider, look around. Because when you're trying to do something and then you feel the fat on your arm squeezing against a bracelet, then you will know what I'm talking about. And it sounds so ridiculous, but like when you're carrying something and it's like a long story. In the end, I was like, just try out the bracelets and then tell me what you think. Yeah.
So look, I still love them, but I love the Star Wheel, right? So I'm going to post an AP, which is probably a unique piece in platinum. Mm-hmm. It's a square Edward Piguet with Corns de Vache lugs, and it's all in platinum. It's probably a unique piece. It was sold in 1992 by Marcus, the famous Marcus of the shop Marcus in London. So I'm going to post that soon. So I mean, those are the kind of pieces I like. They're really rare, eclectic. I still love the Royal Oak. I love the offshore. I have some really rare offshores. I mean, I have the tantalum offshores. I love tantalum as a metal. But yeah, I mean, like it's, yeah, what I don't like is the modern. I don't like the direction. You know, I mean, do you really want to see a three-dimensional Spider-Man with his leg popping out, you know, on your wrist? Is that really what it's all about? You know, or what, I don't know. Is it Spider-Man or what else they're doing? Spider-Man and Pink Panther or something like that? No, Panther? I don't know, one of them.
Black Panther.
I was thinking about it.
I was like, is it called Pink Panther? Wait, so does it make you panic then to be like, wow, I have a lot and it's now gone to this level?
Well, not at all. Not at all. I think I have all the good ones. I don't have a Black Panther. I don't have a Pink Panther. I don't have a Spider-Man or a Superman or Iron Man or whatever else he'll make. You know, I don't have the code. But I love the offshore, and I have the old offshores, which is what I like. Okay. I like the volcano. I love some of those old ones. Actually, you like RM, right? I mean, RM,
it's
running on, it's Renault and Papi, right? It's running on off technology. So, I mean, I love offshore.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I feel the same way as Long about like AP and the double balance. So it's like, do you ever get that feeling, right, where something happens that is really not related to the watch, but it just taints the watch, right?
Yeah.
And so once it's tainted, you'll never feel good wearing it.
Mm.
And that's the thing where I like the double balance as a watch, but the experience of just waiting so long, like after being told that I'd get it, you know, it just leaves just not a great taste in the mouth. But I just don't think I can wash out, you know? Especially now.
I get it, mate. Absolutely. Like, you know,
Like now if they offered it, it's kind of, we all know that like AP prices are tanking quite a bit, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, I wonder, we all know like, okay, those people on the waiting list for those watches, because it will quickly diminish if you actually ask them, do you want the watch? Especially if the watches aren't going to be trading like above retail or even make it worth it, right? It's like for 700K, you put into a watch, you're also looking at the percentage return, right? If you can't get that percentage return, a lot of those people will say, thanks, but no thanks. So then when you get offered it, if I was to get offered it now, it's kind of, well, clearly you're just doing it because like, it might not be the case like that, right? But it feels like, okay, I was a side note and now you're just like coming up to me for it because you couldn't sell it to someone else. And that's unfortunately, that's how I feel about it. It might not be the case. And the brand, it leaves the brand in a very like difficult position. Well, for me, because they can't exactly say, oh no, it wasn't like that, Daniel. It was like this, you know, the brand can't really say that. But, you know, and there's also so many different watches out there. And that you've said, you know, you were in modern Rolex, and then, you know, you've moved on to the neo-vintage phase for Long Long. You know, she was into AP and lots of other stuff, and her taste has changed, you know, completely. She's pretty much all in going into RM now, even though RM has been around for ages. You know, she felt it's a time to just... So you can't, like, my taste has changed. As much as I'd like to say, you know, AP double balance, if I was to take two APs, it'd be like the 15202, like, or something like that, A series or something. And then the double balance. Yeah, that's it.
I have both of them. But see, this is a good point, right? You brought up a key point. This is why I think the dip is the best thing that actually happened. Look at the 15202 jumbo, as you mentioned right now. I remember when it was sitting at 1.2 million Hong Kong dollars, with everyone clamoring for it. Like, people were just sitting there going like nuts, right? They were having an orgasm of their watch, and largely driven by a few YouTube dealers trying to create a market where they could. I saw one sell the other day for a ridiculous price. I'm scared to even mention it because I own a few. And no one wants it. So why is it? Why is it that you were going batshit crazy at $1.2 million, and now at less than half of that, no one wants it? So I think the dip has taken the speculators off, and I think we're back to basics. And I think this is the issue. Yes, Benheimer's was a fantastic success in what he created, the concept of the AP house, trying to create a relationship-based model. I think he's done very well in taking the middleman, etc.
Yeah.
But is he really selling to collectors, or has he been selling to speculators? I think that's the question we need to ask ourselves, right? Because you know, do you look at watches with greed, or do you look at watches with passion? You know, greed isn't a sense. When you want wine, you need sense. Wine is sense, right? To savor wine. Good food requires a sense, right? Passion assets is a very good word, and people use passion assets for watches, but it's the passion that creates the asset. Unfortunately, over the last 3 years, it was the asset creating the passion. That's not what we want, right? So I think the dip's pretty good. And I think, Dan, you're spot on. You know, it's the true collectors now. The 15202 is a lovely piece. Mm-hmm. So is the double balance. But yeah, I mean, I think of the values that they were selling at, it was just ludicrous, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting point you make, actually, in the fact that AP going through their vertical distribution and basically taking back the stock and the supply, getting rid of those retailers, have they in turn not gone too direct to the consumer? They've actually opened the door to a bunch of other people that weren't confined to being a retailer to go and buy the stock. And so they're mostly speculators, you know? Like, have you just tried one evil to a different type of evil?
Yeah. And I think that's the challenge for the new lady. I know she's come from L'Oreal. Now, I don't know what selling cosmetics has to do with selling watches, but I'm sure they know something. You know, but that's her challenge. How do we bring back, you know, simple answer, right? AP buys Roth and everything solved. Yeah. Roth goes back to its It's true. Mm-hmm. And LVMH goes its own way, and that's it. answer solved.
Right. So we're coming to the end of the interview. My last question is, you kind of touched on it, which was that Daniel Roth has been resurrected, but, you know, are they doing it the right way? You know, because it's like one piece in like how many, I don't know, it's a long time basically. Chief, and a lot of for it, like, what, how do you see it panning out?
So there are things they're doing well. By the way, they are in touch with me on and off, and then they'll be even more in touch with me. By the way, I mean, I know there's only 32 pictures on my Instagram, but because I just finally figured out how to take a photograph, it's taken me 2.5 years to do so. Now I'm going to go crazy. So wait until what's coming. There's so much stuff coming. I mean, I've got over 150 watches to showcase. There's so much coming. It's unbelievable. Some of the rarest stuff anyone has ever heard of, right? Now, to answer your question, I think they're doing a good job with listening to the consumer. Remember the part where they had the wrong font and all of a sudden everyone was up in arms? I mean, you know, us watch guys, we're crazy, right? We can write 7 paragraphs over the font on the Rolex bezel and why it's a flat 4 and a fat 4 and a thin 4 and whatever the hell you want to call it, right? So we're a bit of a crazy bunch, right? So people went crazy. They were like, oh my God, this is ridiculous. How can you have this font? You know, this is a modern font in a vintage timepiece. Meanwhile, this famine, sustainability crisis, World War III breaking out, and we're talking about bloody fonts, right? But hey, what happened is they listened to it. And hats off to them, they reacted immediately. But here's where my challenge is. Why is it taking them 2.5 years to produce one model? I don't get it, right? So I thought, I heard through the grapevine again, and I'm in many, many rabbit holes, right? I heard through the grapevine that they're coming out with a big announcement in March. So I said this in the Rotfather interview. I said, let's see what happens.
I just think you're always digging with like rabbit holes and grapevines. You know, like you just can't.
I'm in the Saudi Arabian rabbit hole. And if you look at my WhatsApps there, they're all in Arabic. I don't speak a word of Arabic, to be honest. Right, so it's Google Translate. I'm in the Chinese rabbit hole in all your WeChat groups. I'm in every rabbit hole you can think of and more. I mean, I just love watches, right? So I'm deep in this. So anyway, I don't know what's taking them so long to launch more models. I mean, they launched the Trubalon last year with the 20 piece subscription. This March, I thought they'd launch the Ultra Plat or the Bicompax Chrono, Lemania, the next one. Again, it's the Tourbillon. I mean, okay, we're all obsessed with Tourbillons, but honestly, it's a pretty useless complication, right? I think they can move beyond it to something a bit more interesting. So yeah, that's where I think they're doing wrong. I don't know why are they so slow? But on the other hand, you know, I think they are listening to the consumer, but jury's out on that one. See how they proceed.
Okay, well, that concludes the main interview. It was good to have such a real opinion, like just filtered. That was great. Yeah. Okay. So now we go on to the reverse round. I know you've been dying for this to ask me this question. So what the hell is this question?
So I'm not dying for it. It's just, you know, all your colleagues and friends.
Yeah.
You know,
apparently like Gertrude Thomas to Gertrude, asked me the question.
To Jonathan. There's so many of these guys, right? They've been ask him. So look, I'm just a messenger, right? So don't shoot me.
Okay.
This question's coming from all your friends.
Okay.
And followers and loved ones.
I'm seeing Thomas like well soon, so yeah, I'll give him an ear.
This actually was at Mark Cho's thing. Actually, we were at having a Negroni in his bar when this question came up. So you have this really tough exterior, you know.
I have this really what?
Tough. This really tough as nails sort of persona and exterior, bit brusque, right? You know, I've been there. I've been in London for 9 years. Typical British directness. Many will be put off by it, right? I love it personally. I love it absolutely. But we have this really tough, direct. But then I see this Movado episode, which is, I think, the last episode you shot, right? And we see a very different Dan. Many of your friends saw a very different Dan. We saw this beautiful, soft vulnerability, right? When you start talking about the things that you love, like this Movado, because I know you love it, and I do too, actually. So I get it, and you know, it's the same one that comes out when someone leaves Shanghai out. You know, I didn't mention, by the way, Shanghai is one of my favorite cities in the world. I said it before you did but you know, every time someone leaves out Shanghai or mentions, you'll be like, yeah, but there's Shanghai too. So we see the same softness. So the question is, why do we need the mask? There's so much beauty and softness that sits within you. Why do you hide this beautiful vulnerability with this really tough as nails exterior?
Well, I never knew that.
It's a good
question, right? No, well, it's a very good question. Like, I like these philosophical questions, but I never knew that I had a tough as nails. Like, this is the first time I'm hearing that I have a tough as nails exterior. I mean, like long, long. Is that how I am?
I'm so close to you, so I see the private parts, right? But I guess from the outside.
Oh well, to be honest, I didn't know I was like that, or I was coming across like that. But
that's not an answer to the question, though. Like you asked, you like you said earlier, I'm giving it back to you.
Well, why? Because I think I'm just me. Yeah. So I guess if something touches me or the conversation goes to a particular area, I think I'm quite happy to show that I'm passionate or vulnerable, like, for it. But I guess I've mostly, I think a lot of people would describe me more as a chameleon, you know, a social chameleon. And I think that's how I've been raised, I guess. You know, might have something to do with the fact that, you know, when I was like raised in England, I was, you know, Chinese is a minority, right? So I'm always having to fit in, right? And so I always probably found that. And then not only that, my education pathway has been like, you know, to the top education, to like private tutorship, to it's been a bit all over the place. And I've moved schools a lot. and I've moved like to different areas a lot. So maybe that's the reason why in my personality, I've got a that chameleon aspect. So I wouldn't say like it's two personalities, but it's just probably a multitude of personalities. But then on the podcast, the thing with like this podcast is I don't really do well with bullshit.
Yeah.
Or somebody, and so if somebody's going to come onto the, like, I don't want to say my show, I should say our show, right? And just like say something without a lot of thought, well, I'm going to call it out, right? I'm going to say but not because for the sake of calling that out, because I'm trying to understand what you're actually trying to say, yeah, and actually have a deeper dialogue. Now, unfortunately, deeper dialogue takes time, you know, and for people that, I don't know, have known me, so you've met me and they probably see a different side to me.
Yeah.
But in an hour conversation, an hour and a half with a guest, it's not long enough for me to open up. I guess it takes a lot longer for me to open up than people realize. I actually, to be honest, yeah, I could say that about all three of us, I think. Yeah.
I think you can. But I think that's the, because I probably met you earlier, so I don't know the others as much. But yeah, I mean, look, great answer. But again, you know, there's that beautiful softness which comes out now and then, which your customers, your your guests, your colleagues love. So I mean, do more of that is the lesson, I guess, in this. Less of the, did you say chameleon or comedian? Which one? Sorry.
Oh, no. It's like sometimes you know like sometimes in the office, right? I feel like I'm in the office. You know the TV series, The Office. Yeah. Like,
I love it. It's my favorite series.
Sometimes I see that, like, it's just playing in my mind as I'm in the office. You know, you know how people like make forced conversations, and it's like so forced, man. Like, I wouldn't even bother. You know, I'm just sitting. People like laughing at your boss's joke or something when it was so shit. You know, like you see a lot of that, and I'm just like, yeah, okay, I'm just not very good at like that. You know, that kind of stuff. So.
Takes one to know one, but yeah, absolutely. Question as well.
Yeah, sure.
To ask you. So I'm not going to ask you why you like Quorum so much. That was from Jonathan, actually.
Yeah, I knew it.
I'm also not going to ask you why you have such perfect feet. You can edit that.
That's from Dad.
And I was going to ask you, when am I going to buy you a Negroni at your first watch event? And that's not a pickup line, but you already answered that. So scratch that as well. So let me ask you a proper question.
Mm.
So I think the Movado, the collector you had previously, had a lovely question. He asked you, do you like the why or do you like the how? And I think you went into this thing saying, I actually really like the why. So I think you gave an analogy of, if you kill someone, Dan, I'm not going to ask you how you did it. It's not going to tell me the motive, why you did it, right?
Yeah.
So my question is, why do you like the why over the how?
Because, okay, this is such a bullshit answer, and it makes me sound like I'm some saint, but I'm definitely not a good person, I can tell you. But I'll just, so going back to that example, like Dan kills somebody, my world is like very black and white. So there's a yes box and a no box. And I've explained this to all my closest friends. So in my yes box, I can count the number of people, maybe less than 5. But once you're in that box, I have your back forever. So you go kill somebody. I just want to know what happened and what did I miss as a friend. So I want to know why you did that bad thing. But the rest is just like stories, right? Just like I killed him by, I don't know, suffocating him or whatever. But I definitely care about what that person was thinking and how it came, like how he decided to make that decision. And I just want to like the way you were asking Dan just now about why does he have this hard exterior and so on, I actually thought about something. So we're all really similar in the sense that I think it's because you just don't give a shit about anyone that doesn't actually matter in your life. And when I first knew Dan, and I would call and be like, hey, this thing is bothering me. This person said this about me and this and that and whatever. Or will bitch about someone. And he would always say like, oh, the cream rises to the top. So now I realize that is just essentially how I function, which is everyone that's not in this yes box, you can think whatever you want. I don't give a shit. And I only ask about the people in the yes box. Like, hey, why did you do this? Everyone else is like, just small talk for me. Until you're in my yes box, then I genuinely care. Yeah.
And that's a great answer. Actually, that's maturity, because you'll find the older you get, the more
you don't give a shit.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The more you
So I'm sure if you didn't do this podcast and you met me at the THC event, you'll be like, she's a bitch. Like, because I'm just like, okay, don't give a shit about anyone. Like,
we just bitch about AP together. I wouldn't say that.
So, like, long socially, like, awkward. It's there's a lot of social anxiety there.
People don't realize, because
when she is actually in a social setting, she's pretty much perfect, actually.
Yeah.
She doesn't see it like that, but she is. And so that's why not coming to certain events, because, you know, she'll think about it, like, beforehand.
Yeah, I get it. Totally get it. So what you don't know is, because you're doing this podcast for a while and you're actually, you've actually bared your soul. There's this, we're talking about 200,000 downloads, right? I mean, there's this 200,000 strong community that's totally connected with you and totally gets you. So actually, you should be very proud. I mean, I've never met you, right? But I feel so connected to all of you. And I think that's genuinely what you've created, you know,
Well, that's very touching. I'm glad you did.
Very kind to say.
You know, if you ask me, that would be a very good thing to achieve, you know? Right. Wow, very philosophical. Right. We're going to go on
some rubbish, like quick fire.
Pump push around. Here we go. Right. Number one, your favorite type of Indian curry and why that one?
Chief, I don't even like Indian food. I love sushi. I love Tokyo. I love everything. I can't tolerate too much spice. So
okay.
I actually like, you know, I like katsu curry. Does that work?
Indian curry.
Chief, I'm not going to be allowed back in my own country now.
Curry.
So look, it's got curry in it, right? It's got curry leaves. I like street food. I love the Indian street food. I love a good samosa, you know, with all the trimmings. I said trimmings, like you're having a roast. I need another kampari, guys.
Number two, one thing about Indian culture you hate.
The fact that everyone, you know, I don't know what they call it. Keeping up with the Joneses is the right way. Everyone is interested in everyone else. It's not a culture. It's not like, you know, you have your own space. It's very, what's the other person doing? What car are they driving? What house do they live in? I can't stand that, actually. Absolutely. So that's the part that drives me nuts about it.
Right. And I'm going
to... I'm in Hong Kong, right? I don't speak the language. And I'm a local Hong Kong person, you can see, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's like pure, it's Zen. I don't understand anything. Like a pure, beautiful music. There's cacophony around me, but I love it because I don't understand anything.
Mm.
Right. Number three, one thing about Indian culture you love.
I love the family unit. It's a very good Asian family unit, similar to what it is here. You know, you're supposed to follow in your footsteps. There's father's footsteps. The heritage means a lot. You're supposed to, same like watches, right? Like, you really have to go back generations. So it's that sense of identity, the sense of family, which is, I'd say it's an Asian thing more than an Indian thing, but it's pronounced in India. And I love some of the customs. I love the, you know, even the religious stuff, even though I'm not very religious, but I love some of the customs and culture.
Right. Your best pickup line. I love asking. I love asking the question.
It's been a while, right?
You laugh. Like, it makes me laugh when people come up with this.
Yeah,
it's like the one. No, I can't even think of one. I mean, I just gave you long one. I was like, let's go get a Negroni, right? And
that's
she already said yes.
Instead of being weird.
You got to wait until she actually executes. The yes doesn't mean anything.
Long, tell me the secret of your feet. That'll pick up like that.
Right, next one. Your celebrity crush.
Celebrity crush.
Yeah.
Chief.
Come on, everyone's got one.
I really honestly don't have a celebrity crush. I have many crushes, but not a celebrity crush.
Okay. What about a normal crush then?
Who's the girl who acted in Truly Madly Deeply, or did I even get the movie wrong? You know, with
Ryan Reynolds.
Yeah, with Ryan Reynolds. Who's the lady?
There's like three women in that movie.
Huh? Which one?
There's like three women in that movie.
Yeah, but the main one, Chief. I'm gonna have to Crazy Madly Deeply.
She's the very next the girl next door kind of look, right?
Yeah, I just love the way she smiles. That's my childhood crush.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
I love she's got the little dimple as well, which drives me absolutely nuts.
Right, next one. One piece of advice you would tell your younger self.
Don't sweat the small stuff. Honestly, you know, you talk about social anxiety and this anxiety and that anxiety. You go through the journey and then you realize at the end of it, nothing really matters. I mean, you don't sweat any of the small stuff. And I would give two pieces of advice. The other is you're only competing with yourself. Yeah. There is no competition. It's not it's arbitrary, completely irrelevant what the world is doing. You know, you get better inside, you get the results outside, essentially.
Mm. Okay, good. Like that one. One childhood experience or advice that you received as a child that actually was proven useful as you became an adult?
Again, never forget your roots, right? I mean, I remember an episode where, you know, we had hotels. As you know, we had hotels back in India. And I remember whenever I went back to my hotel, I'd always stay in the presidential suite. But my own father, when he'd go back, he'd stay in the smallest room. So one day, one of our managers saw this and he told my father, he's like, why is it that you, as the owner of the hotel, sleep in the smallest room? And your son, on the other hand, he always goes for the presidential suite. So I remember my dad still saying, he's like, well, he has a rich father. I didn't. So the advice there is never take it for granted, right? I mean, there's ups, there's downs, and you've got to be real all the way through it, actually. So that's one piece of advice I've never forgotten.
That's a great, I like that.
Yeah.
That was so good. I like that story. Yeah. I also like the one where your mom said, I gave you roots or something, but then I give you wings, because sometimes roots can hold you back.
You know?
But they're important as well. You know?
Absolutely.
They give you depth, but they shouldn't like suffocate you. Right. Number nine, what is success to you? What does it mean to you? If someone said, define success, what does it mean to you?
It's happiness. It's actually, that's all we're chasing. We're chasing two things. No matter where you are, what you're doing, you know, it's not about the bank balance. It's not about the number of watches. It's all about love, acceptance, and happiness. And I think those are the three things we're chasing, two or three things we're chasing. Love and acceptance is really important. Yeah.
And the last one, which is linked to that question, whatever your version of success is, which you kind of just said, which is happiness, what is the most important thing in getting there?
That's a tough one. Chief, these are even more philosophical than my questions.
No, I know, right? It's because when I wrote this...
You've been thinking about the last two hours.
You're like, when I wrote this, it was like literally a couple of hours ago, like it was late. So my mind goes more philosophical, like the sunset.
So does mine. Yeah, so what is the... I forgot the question now, Chief.
What's the question? Right. Whatever your version of success is, which you said was happiness... What's the most important thing in getting there? So I guess, like, how do you get there, you know, in your mind?
I think authentic and vulnerable. Be authentic. You know, I went through this entire period of my life where you think that being vulnerable is a weakness.
Hmm.
Actually, it's a strength.
Hmm.
So I think the two things I have taken away is, you know, ultimately, be authentic, be yourself, and be vulnerable. Those are the two things that you know, no one can take away from you.
Hmm.
Right. So whenever we need to do a philosophical podcast, we know who to.
No, but jokes aside, thank you to all of you, you know, for inviting me, and also genuinely for what you created. Lots more magic coming. I mean, I don't know if you've seen my IG, but it's sort of very different than the other IGs. There's a lot of music there. There's creative writing. Some influencers call me Charles Dickens. That's my good friend Phil Toledano from you know, Mr. Enthusiast, he calls me Charles Dickens because of the way I write. But honestly, this is a passion play, and I'm just very happy to be able to spend some of my life doing it, following it.
Great. Well, I can't beat that. I'll see you guys on the next one. Bye.
Bye. Cheers. Bye.
As always, thank you for listening to the Waiting List podcast.
We hope you've enjoyed it as much as we have. And if you have any questions,
comments,
or feedback,
feel free to reach out to us at the Waiting List podcast on Instagram or via our private accounts.
We'll see you on the next one.
Bye.
Bye.